on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Box office top 10 after that entertaining interlude at 10, Broken Embrace.
Well, Broken Embraces, which is a new Pedro Almodovar film, which, again, I've been away, so we need to know.
Oh, you haven't seen that one either?
No, because and you know, never review a film you haven't seen. Funny enough, I'm seeing Broken Embraces on...
Some people do.
Monday. What, who?
Some
yes,
people.
Yes, well, apparently some people do, but we don't ever speak of them. Yes, no, I haven't seen it. Would need a review, and I'm sure it's interesting.
Right, G.I. Joe's at number 9.
Again, so you've called out for it.
Yes,
so.
I have. Greg says, a review of G.I. Joe in one word... regimented. Kilpers in Edinburgh. Dear Simon, don't think I've heard this on your show, so my one-line review of G.I. Joe is as follows. See G.I. Joe.
Very good.
And Joe, a film student, says, Dear Mannering and Wilson, G.I. Joe, an assault on the ears and has an action sequence already done in Team America, but it does have Christopher Eccleston in it and a child sitting behind me crying out, it's Doctor Who! And a little bit of Gerry Andersonness, namely the underground base. Anyway, that's the thought of Joe, the film student. Number 8 is Hurt Locker.
Which I liked. Kathy Bigelow came on the show, and I know that you
I
were
was more enthusiastic
that,
than she was.
Yeah, I know.
What
isn't,
was the point
isn't
of that?
That strange? Well, it's a really odd thing. The funny thing about Kathy Bigelow is, I mean, she made one of the films that is one of my favourites, Near Dark, which is a great, you know, really, really good piece of work. She made Point Break, of course, and she is the most macho director around. And it absolute demonstration of the fact that machismo is actually nothing to do with gender, because she really makes macho films. And in the case of The Hurt Locker, I think it's a good piece of work. It's very nihilistic, and it has this weird sense that at the centre of it, because it's a film about bomb disposal, and it has at the centre of it this figure whose job it is to be slightly reckless, who is clearly on a sort of self-destructive path, and is increasingly reckless as the drama goes on, keeps introducing famous characters, as in, you know, actors that you actually recognise, who then don't last very long, which is I think was a very interesting decision, because it means that you don't know who on screen is safe and who isn't safe. I think it's a very fine and edgy piece of work. I don't know that it's quite the masterpiece that some people have said it is. It's very nihilistic, but it is macho as nuts. Didn't you think so? Didn't you think it's a film that really sort of celebrates the kind of the nihilistic machismo of its hero?
I didn't. Yeah, I just thought it was extremely tense. I enjoyed the fact that it was about bomb disposal, not particularly about Iraq, as we were talking about last week.
No, clearly not.
Could easily have been made about Northern Ireland, a point which they conceded, but it doesn't shed any light about the rights and wrongs of
I think, interestingly enough, it's not even about bomb disposal. I think what it's about is about meat-headed machismo. I think it's about men. I mean, it's a peculiar thing, but Kathy Bigelow makes very, very... She makes movies like Sam Peckinpah.
If she's going to come on, she could be enthusiastic about them, otherwise I won't invite her.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I'm not defending her manner on the programme. I mean, maybe that she's just soft-spoken, in interviews. But she is a very oddly macho director.
Simon and Exeter, dear Sergeant Sanborn and Staff Sergeant William James, characters from the film, I saw The Hurt Locker in the week. I have to say I'm astonished on how brilliant this is. Only a few films have had that effect, but only certain aspects of it, like cinematography, acting, writing, directing. But Hurt Locker is the first where everything left me engrossed. It took only a few minutes and I was no longer in the cinema, having no soundtrack, but with the bomb disposal squad there in Iraq. It's like buses, movies, because it's been years since I've been engrossed in movies, and then two come along in a year, this and The Brilliant Moon, in the opinion of Simon. Dear Stop It and Tidy Up, this is Rob in Manchester, MPhys, brackets, ons in physics, working towards PhD in chemical engineering. Went to cinema last night, forgetting that District 9 isn't out until today, recalling the good doctor's review of The Hurt Locker, went for that instead, and we were very...
Hang on, how can it be... No, it must have been recalling the... it must be Andrew's review of The Hurt Locker. I haven't reviewed The Hurt Locker
exactly,
on the programme before.
A very fine point. It was Andrew and Jason. So Jason and Andrew... Jason Isaacs, hello, wherever you are, sir. Thanks very much, Steve.
Oh, yeah, hello to Jason Isaacs.
You brought a gift, by the way, for your son.
Yeah, I know. I then got sent a text, which was, do not let Mayo keep the tattoo I got for your son.
Yes. we've picked the best one. You've got the second best
one. Yeah, I bet you have.
The Hurt Locker. Anyway, went for that instead. We were very glad we did. An utterly enthralling war film that keeps the adrenaline going throughout. We left the cinema feeling completely exhausted and agreed it was probably the best film we'd seen this year. Now eagerly awaiting your review of District 9. So, the enthusiasm is definitely out there.
No, listen, I do think Hurt Locker is good. I don't think it's quite as brilliant as perhaps some of the listeners are suggesting. But I also, I don't think it's about bomb disposal. I don't think it's about war. I think it's about men.
G-Force at 7.
Which is fine, and yet further demonstration of the fact that the 2D, 3D thing, if you see a film in 2D, it's perfectly fine. You don't need to see things in 3D. 2D films are perfectly fine. They can do everything that 3D films could have done.
At 6, HP and the HBP.
Yes, and I keep now having this ongoing conversation. Almost everybody I meet, who starts talking about film, raises the question of the unhappy event, which you have now put into the national agenda about why it is that Harry behaves as he does when the unhappy event happens. I think, actually, that is demonstration of the fact that I was right I was right when I said that it's the second best movie because it's provoked so much debate about that moment. Sorry, go ahead.
This is Red Robbo from the Cayman Islands. Dear Urquhart and Happer, I was in England when I heard...
Do you get Urquhart and Happer? Do you understand why?
Explain? No.
Local hero.
Oh, is it a local hero?
Yeah, Gordon Urquhart and Happer.
I was in England when I heard the review of the latest Harry Potter with no or little access to a computer. This was the first HP film where I had not finished the book and so came to it with no expectations.
Ah.
The ending, where Harry stood by and was not frozen by a spell, made perfect sense to me. He was snooping and was told to keep quiet by Snape, whom, despite all his misgivings, he'd been told to trust. The assumption and presumably film version Harry made was that he was the good guy. Snape was going up there to save the situation. All of this meant that when, indeed, the unfortunate incident happened, it was all the more shocking for me
and for Harry. I agree with that.
It, of course, deepens his own sense of guilt and anger. The very end was a bit of a washout and didn't serve the rest of a tremendous film well, but the wanton destruction of the Weasley house was also a good addition, as it showed what a nasty, psychopathic arsonist Bellatrix Lestrange did. So,
the destruction of the Weasley house is the one moment that I thought was a false step. The more I think about the end, which bothered me very much at the time, the more I think that actually the arguments for it are coherent and do make sense. And I think that sense of Harry's guilt is going to be very important in the remaining two films.
Aliens in the Attic at 5.
Which is fine, but there is no, it's no more than fine. It's a shame because it's an example of a movie in which all the really good stuff is in the trailer and in the title.
Time Traveller's Wife at 4.
Much correspondence about whether or not there are plot holes in the film that people keep saying, if you read the book, it's explained. But yes, I don't want to read the book. I only saw the film. I need it to make sense from within the film. It's not that the film says anything about whether or not he can go backwards and forwards that is wrong. It's that it doesn't say certain things that are needed to be said in order to clarify why it is that he can only go forwards after he has met his wife in real time for the first time. That said, considering how clearly unfilmable the central text is, they've done an interesting enough job that people are still talking about it. I think Eric Banner's performance is good, and I liked it. As you know, it was my film of the week that it came out, and I thought it was an interesting, if severely flawed, bash at what is, in the end, an unfilmable book.
Right, let's do the top three. Funny People's at 3, a new entry. You haven't seen it. Here's Vicky from Glasgow, BSE, ONS, MCO, PTOM. So MCO...
PTOM?
Yeah. It's probably very important. Dear Lockwood and Lamont, Sunday night posed an interesting dilemma at my local multiplex. After a recent unpleasant breakup from the boyfriend, I found myself standing alone in the foyer, having to choose which movie to see. Option one, The Ugly Truth, would rather stick forks in my eyes. Option two, The Proposal, would probably have pushed me over the emotional edge. Option three, The Hurt Locker, possible, but may have given me ideas as to what to send the ex for his Christmas. So I went for Funny People. This week's number three. Not being a fan of Mr. Apatow's previous films, I had low expectations. Probably what I should have had with my ex. But I was pleasantly surprised, says Vicky. There was two-thirds of a good film. It only fell down when they went for the comedy ex-girlfriend with butch yet sensitive husband ending. I think they should have let him die. But maybe that was the mood that I was in. That's so... Vicky, I still think
she should have gone to Hurt Locker, though. I think that would have, because that would have wiped your mind of any, any feelings of anything else.
And Brett says, I would love to hear Mark's thoughts on Funny People. I loathed this film, and yet I feel like I'm the only person. Please can Mark review this film next week, because I thought Andrew Collins' review wasn't satisfactory.
Yeah, I have to go and see it as well, because there was this that thing that I said on this show, I think is the preferred phrase, about if there were 10 movies worse than Bride Wars this year, I would quit. And there have been 4 so far. And I've had, therefore, several texts from people saying, oh, well, you must check out this, you must check out that, you can't miss this. I mean, it's almost as if people want me to go. But so apparently somebody thinks that Funny People is worse than Bride Wars.
Just let's try and do these last two movies then, before we get to the new films, the other side of the news. So it's Inglourious Hem. Number two, helped here by Cameron in East Lothian. Back in the 70s, because he says about the troubles with saying the title of the new film, here's my solution. Back in the 70s, my friend Graham and I went to see the original movie as half of a double bill with Orca Killer Whale at the Greenwich Gaumont. As we left his house, I distinctly remember Graham telling his mum that we were off to see The Inglourious Bystanders. It worked then, and I can't see why it won't work now. Julian Keane in Toulouse. Once again, the good doctor is so, with 10 O's, right. Having been to see Inglourious Bystanders, as we'll have it for the moment, I went home and felt an uncontrollable need to reassure myself that Tarantino was a proper filmmaker and sat down to watch Jackie Brown again. Watching Inglourious was a bit like sitting down to eat at your mum's, expecting her signature dish, being treated instead to a slightly altered and hurriedly cooked recipe. You end up stopping off for a kebab on the way home to satisfy your hunger. Jackie Brown was my kebab. Nourishing, reassuring, slightly dodgy, with a sense that you're enjoying something that you shouldn't, but strangely satisfying.
Excellent. There was a fantastic bit of criticism by some strange American guy, who's obviously a Quentin Tarantino fan, who has suggested that I'm a fascist because anyone who doesn't like Inglourious Hems is a fascist.
We'll just,
I have yet to fully understand the political import of that.
OK, we'll conclude with three emails on The Final Destination, which you haven't seen. Andrew Brunger saying, in a word, pointless. It seems the filmmakers in charge of the series have totally run out of ideas. Nothing new, nothing exciting, nothing even slightly based on realism anymore. No point. The 3D was quite good, but wait to see these effects in Avatar. Don't waste your money on this drivel. Sam in Tunbridge. It was awful. No characters, terrible effects, death scenes that don't conform to the rules laid down in the first three films. It's proof, final proof, that 3D is not a gimmick, but it's a rubbish gimmick.
Good.
Phil in Sacramento.
The tide is turning, and it began to turn here.
Phil in Sacramento, Final Destination 3D, not exactly a masterpiece, just like the other Final Destination movies, but with more pointy death scenes.
Can I just say on the subject of Avatar, because you know that they showed the footage of Avatar and everyone came out of it going, you know, drooling. And I haven't seen the footage because I don't want to see the footage. I want to see the film. I want to see the finished film. Seeing unfinished footage is just a waste of time because, as my great friend and friend of this show, Nigel Floyd, pointed out, he said, we saw the unfinished footage of Titanic and that looked quite good.
Rosemary Connors with this email. Dear Time in the City. I'm listening to you from a point thousands of miles away at work in Philadelphia, but I feel like I'm in the same room. It's a tribute to you and the Doctor's abundant gifts that I'm able to transcend time and place and absorb the basic goodness that permeates the voice, the spirit and the work of Terence Davis. Your country may not be able to fund Mr. Davis's work, but our country could never pull off such a thoughtful program as yours. We are Liverpudlians all. And that's addressed to Steve Wright in the afternoon. BBC.
And how nice of your mother to write in, Simon.
Indeed. So now, look, a couple of big movies which we do have to include. Very excited about District 9. Posters everywhere. Looks fantastic. It's got Peter Jackson's name in there. Take it away.
Do you want to start with District 9? Do you want to start with 500 Days of Summer and build to District 9? I can do it whichever way around you want.
Well,
let's do District 9 since you just sort of built up to it. You did, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I did kind of gave you a big lead in there.
I know,
yes. Clue,
obviously didn't look at my running order, which said let's start with 500 Days. But never mind that. Okay, District 9. As you quite rightly said, biggest name involved in it is Peter Jackson. It's one of those things. You remember when Cloverfield came out and it was everyone knew the producer's name and nobody knew the director's name. And in fact, nobody knew the cast name. So there is that similarity. So produced by Peter Jackson. And I would argue that there is evidence of bad taste, capital B, capital T, the Jackson movie, bad taste in here. Written and directed by Neil Blomkamp, apparently based on a short film he made called Alive in Joburg, and often when short films get expanded, they don't work out quite so well. So the story, and the guy who's the lead actor, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, I think is Sholto Copley, who's the guy who plays Vickers van der Meer. Have you seen District 9, Simon?
I'm hoping to see it tonight. But...
Okay, fine, great. So story is... an alien spaceship has come and hovered over Johannesburg, and a load of aliens who apparently have arrived by accident have been rescued, in inverted commas, from the spaceship. They've been brought down to Earth. They've attempted to assimilate them into life on Earth. They have become a ghetto. And what happens at the beginning of the movie is we are introduced to our hero, Vikas van der Meer, who is in charge of essentially moving them from the ghetto in which they're in into what they've described as more a spacious living environment, but is quite clearly it's a camp to get them away from everybody else. Now, it doesn't take somebody with a, you know, political studies A level to realise that a film shot around that area of South Africa about a class of people or class of aliens who are living just outside the city and are seen as an underclass and are seen as being sort of, is obviously political in its intention, although exactly what the politics are I think is slightly more complicated than some people have suggested. We're going to play you a clip, but bear in mind that the audio clips for the film came in very, very short bursts. So I think we have put together a montage of some short clips to make a slightly longer clip from District 9.
Very nice.
Where there's a slum, there's crime. And District 9 was no exception. The Nigerians had various scams going. One of them was the cat food scam, where they sold cat food to the aliens for exorbitant prices, not to mention interspecies prostitution, and they also dealt in alien weaponry.
We are here at the MNU head office, Department of Alien Affairs. My name is Vikas van der Merwe. And what we do here at this department is we try to engage with the prawn on behalf of MNU and on behalf of humans.
And obviously, with that, we should explain the obvious. But the prawn is the derogatory word for the aliens, because in a certain light, when they're standing upright, they appear to resemble large sort of shellfish. I think there is some footage of the aliens in the trailers and in the television campaigns, so I don't think I'm giving anything sort of huge away there. So here's the interesting thing about District 9. As you know, there's been great anticipation about it. On the Wittertainment Twitter feed, loads of people have been saying, oh, I'm really, really excited about it. You know, it's got good pedigree. It's obviously political. It's, some of the special effects look really, really good. Am I going to be disappointed? The short answer is no, you're not. It is a really interesting film. I don't think it's perfect, but it is really good. The rule with science fiction is that all decent science fiction is allegorical. It's never meant to be taken literally. Whenever you see films about robots, right? They're not about robots, they're about people. Whenever you see films about aliens, they're not really films about aliens, they're films about people. Or if they are films about aliens, then they're not the best science fiction. The best science fiction is not stuff which is done by people saying, oh, well, genuinely, I wonder what will... I mean, this is, funnily enough, one of my great arguments about 2001, is that the problem with 2001 is that despite the fact that everyone talks about the great allegorical, metaphysical quality of the ending, it is, in the end, based on a story written by somebody who is genuinely trying to extrapolate what might happen if mankind came into contact with another species. Science fiction is a fantasy genre and is meant to be taken allegorically or metaphorically when at its best. So clearly what you have here, the aliens are us, or the aliens are the social outcast, the social underclass. And the treatment of the aliens by the authorities is clearly relevant not only to, you know, historical apartheid, but actually to what's happening now, to do with immigration, to do with movements of people, to do with people being herded out of one country into another country, specifically to do with refugees, to do with people turning up places by accident or by default. Because the interesting thing about the aliens, it's not an alien invasion. Their spaceship appears to turn up completely by accident. And then
sat-nav is wrong? I mean, how is it possible for an alien spaceship with all that technology to end up...
Yeah, I know, but you say that facetiously, but that's actually an interesting plot point.
I wasn't saying it facetiously. I was saying it as an interesting plot point.
You said their sat-nav was wrong. But one of the things is, we never quite know why it got there. It appears that something has gone wrong, and as the drama goes on, there are possible explanations. And one of the explanations offered by somebody who's interviewed on television, because it's kind of intercut with mockumentary footage. They also use real footage, incidentally. Strangely enough, there is some sort of Mondo news footage, which I think, if you're a film fan, relates back to the great Mondo traditions of the, you know, infinitely disreputable cannibal Holocaust and films like that. I mean, that idea of using integrated news footage is something which comes from Italian Mondo movies, although people care not to speak about those things. So we're never quite sure why they're there. We're never quite sure, you know, how they're going to leave or what's going to happen to them. From a cinema point of view, so from a political point of view, I think it's very interesting. I think it works on a number number of different levels, and I don't think it is simply a film about apartheid by any means. From a film fan's point of view, the references are sometimes too bold. I mentioned before that some people might see hints of Cloverfield in there. Clearly there are echoes of They Live.
What about Starship Troopers?
Why? Because bugs. Yeah, no.
By the end, you're thinking, oh, right, I wonder what side I'm
on.
Oh,
well, actually, no, funnily enough, you're quite right, and I dismissed you out of hand, you know, by habit, but actually, if I pause for 2 seconds, no, your point is good. And, of course, Starship Troopers was, of course, about the rise of fascism, and clearly, in the end, was a political tract as opposed to a science fiction tract, and the blowing up of the bugs was, in fact, secondary to the idea that what it was about Nazism. So, yes, good point, well made, I stand corrected. They Live, therefore, Body Snatchers, because obviously They Live is essentially a remake of Body Snatchers. It's, remember that Alien Nation, which was a film, and then I think it became a TV series about aliens living integrated on Earth but being essentially as second-class citizens? There's echoes of that. There's an awful lot of The Fly, the David Cronenberg Fly, not the original Fly, because the central character during the course of the drama experiences metamorphosis, and there are sections of it that are actually too close to The Fly for my liking, things that involve fingernails and bodily mutation that seemed to maybe too readily flag up the David Cronenberg. And then, of course, there are, you know, what I referred to before as the Peter Jackson element, because Peter Jackson's first movie, Bad Taste, which was about space aliens coming down from outer space and behaving appallingly and drinking sick and doing lots and lots of squishy
horrible
things.
That's the kind of alien you want.
Exactly, that's the kind of aliens you want.
Straightforward aliens. You know where you are with him.
I remember when I interviewed him when he first came in. This was when he was a disreputable horror filmmaker. I said to him, you know, how do you make all those noises for the alien squishiness? He said, well, you know, I can't do Australian, but I'll have a go anyway. He said, well, what we do is we get a handful of yogurt and we put it in our hand and we go. And he made a lot of sort of squishy yogurty. So squishy yogurt was the thing that made Bad Taste. But I think you see some of his influence in the film, and also in the fact that, despite the fact that it's got a, you know, serious undertow, there is an awful lot of black humour in it. And so just as a sort of romping space adventure with some nice monster squishiness, it works. As a political allegory, I think it's more complicated than perhaps people are giving it credit for. It's not just about simply about one thing. From a performance point of view, it works very well because you don't really know, or at least I didn't know, most of the people that you see on screen. Sometimes the blending of mockumentary and some stuff which is clearly meant to be filmed and stuff which isn't didn't quite work for me. I mean, I have a sort of headset in which if something's going to be a mockumentary, I want it all to be a mockumentary. If it's going to be a drama, I want it all to be a drama. And what it actually does is it jumbles those formats up. I think it gets away with it. There was a moment when I was thinking, hang about a minute, if this is a mockumentary, how come there's a camera there? Because there's not meant to be. But I kind of forgave it for that. And the fact that I forgave it for that, I think, speaks volumes about the fact that 25 minutes in, I was enjoying it enough to forgive it for the structural flaws that it has. Well, so I think, surprisingly enough, you know, thumbs up, and I don't think people will be disappointed.
We'll continue this correspondence in just a moment because a load of you have seen it already. So we'll do some more District 9. We'll do some... what was
you have to
film?
Do 500 Days of
500
Summer.
Days
I have
of
to
summer.
Do my Zooey Deschanel impression.
Mark in Croydon. I've already seen District 9. I must say it's one of the best films of the year. It mixes two very different styles of documentary and pure film, which shows two sides of the story. Sholto Copley's acting is magnificent, even more amazing considering it's his first film. And the effects are great. That being said, I hope they don't make a sequel and leave it as it is. One of the best films of the year and miles ahead of Inglourious Dialogue. Dodge in Rockland, Maine. Dear Hob and Nob, Biscuit Marines, although I enjoyed my Peter Jackson Presents night at the cinema last week, I couldn't help but thinking what I thought would be an action film rife with political messages quickly deteriorated into The Fugitive with aliens. It was enjoyable and kept my attention, will continue to do so, as me and a friend of mine had a $20 bet on there being a sequel within the next 3 years. As it's
District
based on
10.
An earlier film short, I thought this would be a one-off intelligent popcorn flick, whereas my friend believes the saga will continue due to the ending being very, very open. I think we've given enough already, haven't we?
Well, I mean, all you need to know is that District 9, you know, could be followed by District 10. I'm sure that the sums add up for District 10. I don't know whether the people that made District 9 would want to make another one. I think the fact that they have taken a short and turned it into a very coherent feature film that has an interesting ending, I think is perfectly fine.
What else is new, sir?
Well, 500 Days of Summer, which, if you've seen the posters that are all around the place, apparently, according to, I think it's our very own James King, it's, you know, hey, the hippest, coolest comedy of the year. And that means that the young people are down with it. So I have to apologise in advance because clearly I'm 46, right? So What you need to know is this. It's being billed as sort of Annie Hall for the Twitter generation. And it's a story of a girl called Summer. You see, 500 days of summer. It's
work
a pun.
That one
it doesn't.
Out.
Yeah, it doesn't mean summer goes on for 500 days. It means 500 days of a relationship with summer. In fact, it's got brackets around the title. So the 500 is in brackets and then days of summer. Now, before I play you a clip, I need to say two things. First is that Summer is played by Zooey Deschanel, whose name I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, but if I pronounce it in the voice that she would doubtless say, it's Zooey Deschanel. And she is Summer. And this is a quote from the director, Mark Webb, which I'm going to play you before I play you the clip, which says, "It was the title that finally got me. Something clicked. The writers, without descending into oddball high concept, had conjured up a relationship that felt both artful and truthful, metaphorical and literal. Here is a clip that I hope involves Zooey Deschanel.
You okay?
Yeah.
You sure?
Summer, I gotta ask you something.
What?
What are we doing?
I thought we were going to the movies.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, what are we, like, what's going on here with us?
I don't know. Who cares? I'm happy, aren't you happy?
Yeah.
Good.
And that's kind of the way in which we should probably discuss the film. I'm happy.
No, I don't. I'll be irritated. You're even happy. Though you only got 5 minutes.
He's kind of happy. Everyone's happy.
Can you do that alien squishy noise instead?
It's very heavy, and sometimes it's a bit sad. But what are we doing here? We're being happy, and then so. Now, look, the short version of it is this. The film wants you to believe that the character played by Zooey Deschanel is incredibly sort of, you know, cute and a little bit of kooky goes such a long way with me. And Zooey Deschanel, if you look in the dictionary under kooky, there will be a picture of her doing that thing that she does with the big wide eyes, slightly scared deer in a headlight. Oh, Zooey, got a fringe coming down over my big wide eyes. But I like the Smiths. And it's, you know, it's kind of...
I like the Smiths.
Yeah, because one of the things about this film... No, hang on, because one of the things about the film is it's about people who like the Smiths, right? Now, it's a weird thing. See, I love the Smiths and I love Morrissey, but I hate people in films who like the Smiths or like Morrissey. And in fact...
What does that tell you about yourself?
No, I know. It's a strange self-loathing thing, isn't it? It's like that thing in Clerks when he says, I love gatherings, but you hate people. I know, it's so ironic, isn't it? There's a certain type of person who, when depicted on screen, just... makes my hackles go. I mean, it's like the sound of... And I don't do dippiness. I don't do kookiness. I don't do... The last time I saw Zooey Deschanel, she was in that film with Paul Dano, right? And they don't come more kooky than Paul Dano, who's fantastic in There Will Be Blood. And incidentally, Zooey Deschanel was very good briefly in The Assassination of Jesse James because she's being directed to do something else. But when she appears to be playing herself, when she is kind of queen of indie, you know, everything, you know, navel-gazing, let's look at the shoes, stars, trees, and I just go... And there's a pun in the centre of them. 500 days of summer, she's summer, 500 days of summer. And it's one of those, and it's all done because it's described again by its creators as a postmodern love story, which again makes me go, please don't describe anything as a postmodern love story. So we have the days, but the days are told out of order. And there's a narration which has no reason to be there and should be lost completely. And there are some nice little moments in it in which they do that thing about capturing the awkwardness of young love. But there are great long sections of it in which I think the problem with this film is that it's essentially in love with kookiness, with strangeness, with weird, with indie, with shoe. And I just think I'm not interested in that. And I think it's very... telling that the film clearly worked for James King in a way that it didn't work for me, and I don't think it's just because critics think differently about things. I think it may well be
he's young and you're not.
Well, partly that, and also partly because I think that he is blessed with the spirit of the love of mankind, and I like people to say what it is that they mean, and I don't like kookiness, and I think that there is a thing about cinematic romance. I mean, I think if you look at Annie Hall is the ne plus ultra of kookiness on screen. Diane Keaton in Annie Hall is as far as I will go for kooky, right? When Diane Keaton in Annie Hall says la-di-da, she can just about get away with it because it's Diane Keaton, but any further than that, and we tip off, well, Zooey Deschanel has taken it, she's to go back to the 2001 reference, she has gone through the Stargate of kook and has come out the other end as the sort of, you know, the wide-eyed dear child of the universe going like this, oh yeah, we're happy and now we're not happy.
Kooky's beatnik slang, by the way, and probably comes from cuckoo.
Does it?
Yeah,
well, I think, so. Yes. Cuckoo is... So, let me just point out, if the filmmakers are listening, a couple of notes, which I did make to be
I've got
serious.
A couple Firstly, of emails on this to fit in before four.
OK, very quickly, don't use references to The Smiths. Don't fall into pastiches of other movies. Those bits don't work. Don't call anything a postmodern love story. Don't put things out of order if you haven't got a really good reason for doing with it. Don't use a voiceover if it's not necessary. And please cut down on the kookiness.
Alistair in Glasgow. Dear Dr. Inglourious and Dr... Well, I watched 500 Days of Summer this week, found it thoroughly enjoyable, hour and a half. However, it did seem to be rather conflicted, stuck halfway between being a straight-up romantic comedy and something more interesting. A better film was in there, waiting to get out. Too often all the interesting edges were smoothed out good, but not as good as it might be. Barnaby and Billericay. Dear Mark and Mayo, I saw 500 Days of Summer yesterday and thoroughly enjoyed it. Once in a while, you get a romantic comedy... That's a real gem. Genuinely funny, intelligent, and in a way rather moving. It's the latest rare example of this dwindling genre. Even Zooey Deschanel managed to remain bearable. The time hopping back and forth may seem like Damages meets Love Actually, but the format is quirky rather than irritating and fits the witty rhythm of the script. Superior to many romantic comedies released in the past few years, this had me smiling and frequently laughing from begging to end, or beginning even, to
from begging, yes. Begging. Well, I think from begging to end. Well, I'm sorry, I'm out on a limb on this, but it didn't work for me. It grated with me, although there are some things in it that are quite charming. Can I just say a genuinely kooky rom-com recently was Anvil. That is a proper cynical rom-com that's genuinely about love.
And our movie of the week.
Well, District 9, I think, is well... Although I don't think it's flawless, it is the film of the week.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, head to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode and check out my blog, Kermode Uncut.